How can a city architect be the catalyst for urban transformation? Hi, my name is Marcin Wojciech Żebrowski and welcome to the newest episode of Urbcast, my podcast about urbanism, cities, architecture and many more. Today I have an enormous pleasure to welcome you to the episode with the city architect of Melbourne, Rob Adams. We will be discussing the huge transformation that Melbourne went through over a couple of last decades, and Rob was one of the people responsible for that amazing change that we can experience nowadays. We are discussing in the big World of Architecture Congress week here in Copenhagen. Rob visited our office here at Henning Larsen, gave an amazing presentation and agreed to share some more thoughts with me and you, dear listener, about how to transform a city using its community, speaking to the community and really involving it into the whole transformation process. We are discussing also the role of the city architect and how to attract young talents, designers, architects, so that they can work in a city architect office. We lastly talk about the collaboration between a city office and designers, private office, architecture offices, and how can architects be better listeners so that they collaborate with city councils like Melbourne. Welcome to this inspiring conversation with the city architect of Melbourne, Rob Adams. Let me just start with saying that I'm so happy and honored to have you here on this podcast. Welcome, Rob.
It's a great pleasure, and it's good to be in Copenhagen again.
And today we will, even though Copenhagen is a great city and I guess it is inspiring one for you as well, but today let's focus on the other city, Melbourne. We will be discussing the development of the city and the big change, the big transformation that the city went through, and you contributed to many of those changes.
I was very lucky to. I arrived in Melbourne in 1983, and there was political change happening. We had people who were coming into local government, politicians who were worried about the direction the city was going in. And also at the state level, the Minister for Planning was an architect, and they'd come into power specifically to change the city. And I was employed as one of five people to help write a strategy, and I was... my part of that was the urban design part of that strategy. So that's the first time I've been invited in to change a city.
Mm. Do you think it was some kind of a coincidence? I would love to just get some background, get some story behind you becoming the city architect for Melbourne. I'm very curious, how does one become a city architect of Melbourne?
Look, I could tell you that it was because I had a strong reputation as an urban designer, but that wasn't true. But what I had done in 1975, I went back to university to study a master's at Oxford Brookes University. And my wife and I set up a share house. And in that share house were two Mexicans, an Italian-American, a Singaporean, and two Australians. And when many years later, in 1983, we decided to immigrate to Australia, I was working in Sydney and there wasn't much work. 1983, there was a recession, and the office I was working in was running out of work. And I went home on a Friday night and I said to my wife, I need to find a new job. The job I'm working on will be finished this week. And I picked up the newspaper and there was an advertisement for an urban designer to work in Melbourne.
But in Melbourne.
And I read through and I looked at this and I thought, this is amazing. You would have to do the course that I'd done to respond to that advert. And then I looked at the bottom and it was the person I'd given a room to in the house in Oxford. And he had written it for the other Australian who was working in Oman, but he had decided not to come back. So there they had a redundant advert in a Saturday paper. And I phoned him on Monday morning and I said, Jeff, I'd like that job. And I went for an interview and I was lucky enough to get the job. So luck, circumstance, I don't know.
And it was all around back in the 80s.
It was 1983. And If you think back to what was happening in 1983, there was a recession. Cities were not doing so well. And Melbourne in particular was not doing very well. In fact, people were leaving the city. They didn't have a residential population in the city. The shopping centres in the suburbs were growing up. Mm. And so the city was becoming a place that people went to 8 to 5 to go to business, to go to the office. And they might go back on a Saturday morning, but shops weren't open on Saturday afternoon. They weren't open on Sundays. So there was no reason to go to the centre of the city. Mm. And this is why the politicians said we need to somehow change it. And the aim became, how do you build a 24-hour city, but not a city that looks like some other city, a city that looks like Melbourne, that has the characteristics of Melbourne. And that was what the strategy was about. Mm.
How did you identify the identity of the city? Because I think that it is, of course, I think that every city is different and it's hard to copy-paste solutions from city to city. But how does one identify what's the really, the spirit, this genius loci of a place, of a city?
Well, again, I was 6 months out of Zimbabwe, so I didn't know much about Melbourne. I'd just arrived. Mm. But fortunately, what happened in the 1970s is a lot of the communities that lived close to the city were also worried about the city, and they started to develop what were known as community plans. So they started to put down ideas that they thought the city needed. And a lot of these were about, you know, using the local materials, you know, reinforcing the characteristics, be it the, you know, the grid pattern of the city, or the rivers that ran through the city, the three rivers, and, you know, making those a more important part of the topography of the city. So really what we did is we looked at those characteristics, and one of the strong characteristics of the central city was that the blocks were very big. They were 200 meters by 200 meters. And then the surveyor who laid it out in the mid-19th century put a 10-meter road through. But still, the blocks were big. So to make money in the 19th century, they subdivided and they put lanes and arcades through to connect to these buildings that they'd subdivided. And they had a height limit, 40 meters. So everything built up to 40 meters and was like cake in a tin. You know, it fills up to the edges and then you had these lanes. And so the built form of the inner city was much about lanes and arcades. And what we did is decide to take those from being service lanes and make that our pedestrian system. So it was those moves where you identify something that's special about the city and you say, we're going to make that better. Mm. And with the lanes, we allowed people to, you know, use some of the footpaths to put chairs and tables on. The liquor license allowed you to drink, you know, with your meal. Mm. And suddenly these lanes became an important part of the city life.
Mm. How did you start the whole research, the whole study of those alleys and the streets? Because nowadays, of course, we are lucky enough to have all the tools, the 3D modeling, all the drones that can just map the things in the city. So it's kind of easy, I would say, or at least way easier than it used to be in the 80s. What was your approach?
In many ways, we didn't have the data. And so you had to establish the principles and some stages the targets that you wanted to achieve. So the principle was we would not, because they were starting to sell off the lanes so people could consolidate them and make bigger buildings. We said we won't sell any more lanes, so we'll keep the lanes we've got. We will encourage people to use the lanes. We didn't try to pick winners. We didn't say this lane is going to be better than that lane. We just said generally we will support people who want to improve the lanes. And we allowed that to happen naturally. Mm. But then the biggest move we made was, if you're going to make a central city work 24 hours, you need people living there. And we decided we needed to have a residential population in the central city. And at that stage, there were only 685 residential units in the central city. And you say, how did you collect the data? I can tell you, we were putting this report together and they came to me and they said, well, you're the urban designer. How much residential do we need in the central city? And I said, you need 8,000 units and you need to do it in 15 years. And they went away and put it in a report and nobody asked me where I got that figure from.
Where did you get it from?
It was a strong feeling that if you got 8,000 people living in the city in 15 years, that city would change. So it became an aspiration. It became a target. And it's quite often we won't move until we've got all the data, and I understand that. In this day and age, we can get the data. But if you haven't got the data, you need to look at what is the vision, you know, what is the objective we're trying to achieve here? Mm. And then sometimes you just need to set the target and then work out, how am I going to get to that target? So when I said 8,000 in 15 years, I didn't even know how that was going to happen. And it only started to happen 7 years later.
I like this fake it till you make it approach. You just set the goal and then you just try to achieve it. And then luckily, hopefully you achieve the goal. And I think that's a very lucky situation that Melbourne is in right now with being perceived as a very livable city. But before it all happened, you proposed this first comprehensive strategy for Melbourne that we already started discussing. Can you say something more about this? So how can such a strategy, and specifically the strategy that was made for Melbourne, how can it influence the city? Because sometimes cities have those problems that they create some documents and then they just put it on the shelf. Yeah. They never use it.
Yeah. Look, I think that's a really important question because, I mean, the strategy was, I don't want to use the word simple because nothing's that simple, but the strategy was quite pragmatic. Mm. You know, it basically said, if we've got something that's good, let's make it better. You know, so the lanes get better, the parks get better, the waterways get better, our roads get better, our streets become streets for people. But the politicians were scared that's what would happen. You know, we spent 18 months writing the strategy and they only come for 4 years. And if you then don't get the change in the culture of the organization to implement it, it could just go on the shelf and then people carry on doing what they were doing before. So what they did is they established what was known as the Urban Design Subcommittee. And first of all, they said, once we'd written the strategy, would I stay on and help them make it happen? And I said I would, but I needed an in-house team. I didn't want to just be pushing a file from one side of the table to the other. I wanted people who could design and build and change the city, and therefore they would have the internal knowledge to keep the strategy going. But the other thing is they established this Urban Design Subcommittee, and one of the councillors who was very strong with the strategy was the chair of that committee, and I was the person who resourced it. And everything that came through to go to the planning committee to get approval to be built had to come through that subcommittee first. Mm. And what we said to the two of us is that if it's not in the plan, it's not going through. And so when a traffic engineer came in and said, we want to widen the street and we want to put a slip lane in so the cars can go around the corner at 60 kilometres, we said, no, that's not in the plan. In fact, the plan is to make the streets more friendly for people. So we want to narrow the lanes and we don't want any slip lanes. In fact, we want to take out the slip lanes that are there.
Mm.
And they would go away and they'd make small adjustments and they'd come back. And then I can remember him saying when they came back the second time, well, clearly you are not going to spend your budget this year because this plan's not going through. So we will give your budget to someone else. That changed the culture. They then understood that they were not going to do anything unless it was according to the plan. So then they started to understand the plan. And within a few weeks, they were back and the roads were narrow and there were no slip lanes and the pedestrian times had increased rather than the car times. And that changed the culture. And the importance of that is not just to change the culture, but to make everybody in the organization proponents of the strategy. So the traffic engineers then started looking for how can we take road space away? And over 30 years, we took 80 hectares of asphalt out of the central city and put it to widen footpaths or public open space. So that was fundamental, that you need to change the culture of the organization, not just have a strategy.
You say that you have to have everyone aligned, but I think that it's rarely possible that everyone agrees with everyone. And here I would like to ask you for even a wider picture. How do you convince the residents of the city, the policymaker, that the idea of those of the transformation and making cities for people is the right one? Because even nowadays, we have all those different strategies, we have all those different concepts like the city of proximity, the 15-minute city, the cities that are for pedestrians or for bike users. But every time there is someone who is against and opposes that.
Sure. I think I mentioned at the start of this discussion that we had those community plans in the 1970s, and we took those and we really interpreted that. So I see my job very much as a choreographer, that, you know, you take those ideas, so they're not your ideas, they're the ideas that came from the community, and we embedded those in the plan. So what that did was when people read the plan, they could see the things they had been saying written into the plan.
Mm.
So what we were doing is re-establishing trust, because quite often the problem is there's not a trust between the community and the government, because too many plans have been, you know, developed, and then the things that happen the community doesn't like. So we kept that trust. You know, we kept on saying to them, for instance, to the car lobby, we said, we're not going to take all the cars out, but we need to get a balance between cars, public transport, pedestrians, and bicycles. So we need to take some of the space and give it to the pedestrians, but the cars can still have access. So if you go to Melbourne today and you go downtown, there's only one street that has been pedestrianized, and it's only 200 meters long. It's right in the middle. It's called Bourke Street Mall. For the rest of it, even when we closed the main street through to through traffic, we still kept cars that could come into one block and you could drop off at the shops, but we widened the footpaths by 3.5 meters and we planted trees. And we took a lot of cars out because through traffic doesn't actually make a city work. So for me, the challenge is in a city to not be so rigorous and idealistic to say we're going to change it completely. Mm. But change it incrementally. Take small steps, incremental steps that are changed. So if you widen a footpath by 1 meter and plant 10 trees, which is our first project, people say, oh, that street looks nice now. Oh, well, should we do it in your street? You know, and then slowly you build that momentum. So the public doesn't always agree with what we do, and you know, then we have bigger discussions. We've used community committees where we, you know, get a cross-section of people out of the community and we tell them what our problem is and ask them to help us with a solution. So you need to build that trust with the community.
Mm-hmm. So it's the crucial role of the trust, and that was the backbone of the success, or of the beginning of the successful transformation that I would like to discuss now. When was the first moment, or what was the first thing that make you really believe in this change, in this transformation, that you realize that, wow, I think it's really working?
Well, we started the strategy in 1985, so that's when it was adopted. 1992, so 7 years later, was a year in where we closed that main street, Swanson Street. We started Postcode 3000, which was bringing back the residential population to the city. The state government at the same time, the river had been on the edge of the city and had been used very much as a drain, and they had decided that it needed to be taken back to being a decent river. And they'd started to develop on the south of the river, and they put a promenade right along the south bank. And all of that happened in 1972. And when that happened, I thought, wow, we can change the city. And then the thing was, we realized that a lot of the things we were doing were quite small. You know, we're just widening a street a little, planting a few trees, designing new furniture, making the public realm better. And someone in my office came to me and said, Rob, we need to measure the change because people won't realize that the city's changing. It's like warming up a bath. So I listened to that, and we contacted Jan Gehl because he had been talking about, you know, what you don't measure, you don't care for. And we asked him to work with us. And he came to the city in 1994, and we did a survey of, you know, how many chairs we've got, how many pedestrians, how many sidewalk cafes, etc. And then he came back, and it seems like a long time, but 10 years later. And the data was so stunning in terms of the change. The number of chairs had gone up higher than Copenhagen's number of chairs. You know, we had a residential population living downtown. We'd gone past the 8,000. That he started to talk about the transformation of Melbourne. And that became infectious. The politicians became excited that the city was changing and they were part of it. And that's where the momentum built. So, you know, it was a slow start and it was small steps, but it built after that. And then the city started to change rapidly. And then we could make bigger moves. Mm-hmm. You know, we could take out railway yards and create a new 8-hectare park. You know, we could close half a road and have a linear park of 1.7 hectares. But it was a slow case of building that trust and building the trust with the politicians as well.
To counter that, was there a moment that you were maybe losing faith, or maybe some hardships that you could also share, but of course in a form of some kind of lessons learned, so that the listeners, many of them city makers working in municipalities, could implement?
Sure. Look, I think the one good thing about working for the city is very early on, they allowed us to make mistakes. And you didn't get fired for making a mistake, but you had to fix it. And one of the biggest successes, which was bringing 65,000 people to live downtown, was also to a certain extent one of the big failures. Because what we did in 1980s, we had a planning scheme that said, if you were going to build in the central city, you could build six times the area of the site that you owned. And you could do that as of right. So you could get a planning permit and build for six times the area. If you wanted to go to 12 times, then you had to give a public benefit. So there was a bonus scheme. You had to preserve a historic building or contribute to the public realm or have a through block link so you got more lanes and arcades. And there was also a height limit that once you got up to 40 meters, which was the old height of the city, you had to set back by 10 meters before you could go any higher. And we thought that that would control the development because it would mean that some of the smaller sites, if you set back 10 meters, if they were on the corner, you didn't have a site big enough to develop. So that would keep a lot of the historic fabric. Unfortunately, as I said, we were not the planning authority that was at a state level. We certainly were involved in the planning and we gave advice and we dealt with the smaller projects, but not the big projects. And I think the excitement of seeing the economy change and all this building happening, they said, oh, maybe we don't need plot ratios. We've got built form controls. You know, maybe it's enough to go to 40 meters and set back and then let the building go higher. And so they removed the plot ratio. With that, they removed some of the things we were getting through the bonus, like, you know, the heritage buildings. So we lost something there. And then a few years later, they removed the setback. That, to me, was one of the biggest mistakes that ever happened in Melbourne because it made every site in the downtown a development site. So historic buildings were getting knocked over. People were building right off the street. They were putting parking garages for seven stories before you got to eyes on the street. And a small area of the city got built like that before people realized that this mistake had been made. And they started to change and bring back the controls. So there are parts of the city you go to and that old thing that it was going to look and feel like Melbourne, they don't look and feel like Melbourne. And I think also the other mistake that I realize with that excitement of bringing back the population is that you pushed out certain people who are already living in the city who couldn't afford the new accommodation. So the gentrification of the downtown became a problem. And we've had to go back and look at how we get affordable housing back into the centre. So I think those are lessons that cities need to learn. You know, how do you, you know, build density, but also build it in a way that's affordable for people who want to live there.
Do you think that any of those mistakes are reversible?
I think they are. Obviously, a building that's been built to 120 meters is not going to be pulled down, so that's not reversible. But what is reversible is to bring back some of the controls and keep the heritage fabric. So we've just recently updated all the conservation studies for the central city. So there are more buildings now that are listed that you can't knock down. And that means that we keep that fabric. But what we're also doing is we're requiring developers now to start to put affordable housing into their developments. This has been done by other cities, you know, many years ago, but we're a bit late in catching up. And so you can start to get affordable accommodation downtown. But I think the biggest thing that the Australian cities can do is they need to realize that we've got a central city that's very dense and mixed use and walkable. But the suburbs now go for kilometers. And that's no longer a city that has mixed use and density and is walkable. And I think the challenge for the Australian cities is how do we intensify? How do we bring a population back into that broader city and stop taking up agricultural land and pushing people further and further away from where they want to work?
Intuitively, no one wants to commute for 2 hours or more and spend an enormous amount of money on cars. I think that it is somehow achieved in Copenhagen, also due to its size, but there are more and more cars in the city as well. So I think that this is a huge challenge posed on cities worldwide. I would like to discuss a bit more about the role of a city architect itself. Do you feel that you have power and influence over the city? Because we've been discussing the strategies, and I was wondering how powerful position is the one of a city architect?
I think there are two types of roles for city architects. Mm. The city architect used to be a role where there was a city architect's office, and the city architect employed architects and landscape architects and if you're lucky, some industrial designers. When I was asked to stay on at the city and help put the strategy in place, I said on one condition, I want the architect's office back. I want people that actually work on projects, that design projects, that design furniture, that design landscapes. And I also want people who deliver projects, project managers. And the reason I said that is that I became aware that these things have been contracted out and the city architect just became an advisory role. And sometimes
ambassador
with very little power, you know, a need to influence and advocate, but not a lot of power. Our councillors let us have the traditional office. And so we were able to build and design projects, not all of them. If they were big projects, we went into association with other consultants. But what that meant is we had people inside who understood how cities work, who understood how development works, could have a discussion with a developer and understand where the pain was and when the wool was being pulled over their eyes. Therefore, the position became a very strong position. In fact, you had the chief executive of the organization, and the role of the city architect, or it was not called that, was in fact one of six people at the top of the organization who could influence, you know, how money was spent, because the program was being developed by that office in discussion with the politicians. So in Melbourne, it's been a very strong position. And I think that is, I believe, but obviously I'm biased because I've held that position for 40 years, is I think it's because there was that office and there was an intellect that we were able to carry the strategy for 40 years. And we were able to garner trust with not only the politicians, but the developers, the other consultants, the design environment, and the community. And so it's been a very important position, and one that I still think is amazing that someone should ever have that opportunity. And I look back on it with, you know, with great humility that, you know, you can have a position like that. And it's not what you are. That team was the team that had the strength. You might have been a choreographer, and we wanted quality. We've won over 160 awards, national, international, and local. So, and it's not about the awards, but people want to come and work for you because they see you doing good work. And if you can get good people working inside, then you can give good advice to government.
It's a great segue to the last segment of this conversation, because I wanted to ask you about the collaboration. Also the one with the private sector and the collaboration within architecture, urban design, urbanism industry. I don't remember the exact numbers. Maybe you can help me here. I think it was in the UK that back in the 50s or 60s, over half of all architects were working for the public sector. They were working for the municipalities, for the nationwide councils and so on.
46% of the architects in the UK used to work in the public sector.
So almost one out of two was working
for
the public sector.
And now it's less than 1%.
Exactly. And exactly that's my point. Now it's less than 1%, which is a huge, huge, huge change. How does that situation look like in Australia, in Melbourne? So how much of the work, the design work, the development work is done publicly by the city, and how much do you collaborate with private firms, private sector?
I think Melbourne and central Melbourne has had the luxury of this office with 85 people that are in that office. The small jobs we tend to do ourselves. For instance, the details of the city, the paving, the furniture and things like that, we do that. And they've become standard. So if a developer is building a development, we've got standard details and we say those are the city details. When you finish up, that's how the footpath needs to look. That's the furniture we use. So all of that small stuff gets done by the city. A lot of the strategic thinking gets done by the city as well. But if the project gets too big, then our role might be one of doing the conceptual design and then getting a partner to help document and deliver that project. And so the park that I was talking about, where we took out the railway lands, 8 hectares, we did the initial design. It got the approval and the planning permit. But then we went into partnership with a firm of landscape architects, and they did the detailed documentation under, you know, in collaboration with ourselves, and then it got built. We managed the construction. We had a project management team that managed that. But that is the exception. Some of the bigger cities don't have that. Smaller cities certainly don't have that. But what I've noticed in the last few years is there are teams now starting to build in some of those smaller cities and the bigger cities off the back of this example, because Melbourne has shown that this can be successful. And the politicians, I think, are also realizing that you need that in-house intellect, because it's part of the discussion with them and the interpretation of their ideas that these people who are skilled and creative can do. And so I hope that, you know, the strength of that position will come into a much wider spectrum, but we'll have to wait and see. I'm worried that it's gone out of government. And I think that's why you get so many bad decisions, because if you have to write a contract or a brief for something and you haven't actually built anything or designed anything and you're just a project manager or a risk manager, the likelihood is you're going to get it wrong. And so if you're going to have creative people internally who've done that, they'll most probably give you a good brief and they'll know what they want to get out of the brief, which is even more important.
Wow, that's really eye-opening. I feel like this is an extraordinary situation you have there in Melbourne with such an awareness as well, especially if it comes to building briefs and imagining the city. We already mentioned designers and architects and offices that you would collaborate with, especially on the bigger projects. And I wonder, because we are sitting now at Henning Larsen office and you've just gave an extremely interesting presentation here. How can architecture offices, urban design offices like Henning Larsen contribute to the development of your city? And what's required? Like, what's an ideal partner for such a city like yours?
I think the ideal partner, be it the developer or the architect or the landscape architect, is one who comes to the conversation with an open mind. Because we don't for a moment think we know it all. And in fact, I think the collaboration on the projects always makes it better. But quite often we are in a position to say, look, with any development, there's six things that we really need. It might be we need some more open space. We need this development to interact with the street. We don't want blank walls. We need protection in summer or when it's raining. And we also need a link that goes from this street through to that street. And those become the important things for us. And sometimes it's not the architecture, and the architects in my office sometimes get cross with me because I say, I don't want you commenting on the architecture. I want you commenting on the things that affect the way that this building sits in the context of the city. And if it's a good building, the public realm will be better when it's finished than when you arrived. So I think the benefit we get from going into collaboration with architectural firms is they bring a very strong architectural idea, and that combines with a very strong urban idea that we have. And the combination of those two things usually give us a better project. And there's one being finished at the moment in Melbourne up by the Queen Victoria Market, which is mixed use, and it's provided the ability for us to close a big car park and turn it into an open space, and it's going to have it's got a library in there and all of that. I look at that and I think that is the ideal collaboration. We got everything we wanted and the developer got everything they wanted, and the public look at the building and they say, that's a good building. In fact, that's a good piece of city. And I think it's got to be a good piece of city, not just a good building.
As I understand it, it's about listening. It's about being humble.
I think it is. And I think we all need to be humble because, you know, there are so many voices that have been unheard in our cities. And we've now got the wherewithal to listen to those voices. You know, social media has given us the ability to listen. And so where before you might go to a town hall meeting and the same 20 people used to come that you'd been talking to for the last 5 years, that's not the community. That's 20 people who happen to be interested citizens and like to turn up to meetings. So how do you get to the wider voice of a city? How do you get to the young people? How do you get to the students? We have a lot of students in our city and they're only there for a few years, but they make up 40% of our community. So how do you talk to them? You know, what's the language we use to understand what they need out of the city, which could be completely different from the people who are leaving a house in the suburbs and coming to an apartment in the city and their children have moved on and now they just want to be close to where the action is.
You posed some big questions at the end. I don't know if we will be able to answer them, but I leave them open to the listeners. And I would love to summarize that discussion with a book recommendation. Earlier, you've mentioned that you've been very influenced by Jan Gehl's books. And I think that this is amazing material, of course. So would that be a recommendation?
It would be a recommendation. I think the first one you should read is The Space Between Buildings, which is his oldest one. But then all of his other books talk about, you know, how you design cities for people. The other one that I think is a good one is Soft City by David Syme. And David worked with the Gehl office. And that, I think, is a very good book that observes. And then I couldn't help but mention that we wrote a book called Urban Choreography, Melbourne 1985 and Dash. And that starts to tell the story, not very well, I'm afraid, but it does tell the story of that transformation of Melbourne.
Rob, thank you very much. It was extremely, extremely inspiring to have you here on the show, and I hope that listeners will also appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much for listening to The Newest Conversation, and I hope that you got inspired, because for me it was such a great opportunity. Extremely inspiring conversation with Rob, with extremely important thoughts that I would like you to take further, especially if it comes, how does one transform a city for the better inclusively? So basically incorporating all the thoughts from its community. How to learn on your own mistakes, as well as how to collaborate as a private company or as an architect, designer with the city councils, and how to make the cities better places to live. Thank you so much, and talk to you soon.